Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Nicola here, a techie one. Apologies, we're still having a few technical issues with our sound, so we've done our best with this one and we hope it doesn't spoil your enjoyment too much. We're working on getting it fixed as soon as possible.
Hi, welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Heather and I'm the chair of this week's podcast, and we'll be sharing what we're looking forward to in 2019. And I'm joined by Teresa, Steph, Nicola, Linda and Pat.
Hi!
This week, Steph's going to ask us to name the novel. Linda will be reading her work in progress. Nicola will be amusing us with her thoughts for this week. And Pat's going to tell us about the passive and active voice. Okay, so over to Steph.
Name the novel.
Right. I've got, I think this is going to be quite an easy one. I think you're all going to get this because you'll all have read it. So, this debut novel is about a grandmother and it's set in Dorset in England. It won the Costa Book Award for first novel in 2014 and the Betty Trask Award in 2015, as well as being nominated or longlisted for four other major prizes in 2014-15. So debut novel about a grandmother set in Dorset.
No.
You've all read it. I know you have.
You've all read it?
Yes.
No, I'm not sure I have.
Clue two then. The grandmother, Maud, developed the conviction that a friend is in danger. Heather's got it. But her ramblings are dismissed by those around her as the obsessions of a senile woman.
I've got it.
Maud's daughter, her friend's son, her carers, even the police won't take her seriously. So Maud arms herself with handwritten notes and begins her own search for the truth.
Yeah.
Right. Four out of the five have got it.
Not me.
Well, I haven't read it, but I guess from the description that it's been.
I haven't done clue three yet.
Okay.
Well, let's see if you get it on this one then, Linda. Mm. The clues Maud discover lead to a dark secret in her past and the unsolved disappearance of her sister, Suki, who vanished in the late 1940s.
Okay, clue four?
No.
Sounds good. Sounds like a good book, doesn't it?
Definitely.
Okay.
Elizabeth is missing.
Yep, bye. Emma Healy. Yes, Elizabeth is missing. Yes, Elizabeth is missing by Emma Healy.
Mm.
You haven't read it, Linda.
I haven't, but I'm going to because I love that kind of thing.
I haven't read it either, but I've had a copy of it for a long time. It's part of my Sudoku. But, I must get around to it.
I loved it. I thought it was a really positive treatment of Alzheimer's from the person suffering from the Alzheimer's, except they didn't feel like they were suffering. It felt like they were just coping with something they'd come to terms with, and the way that she did that was very funny on occasions. I liked it.
It was probably one of the first books about memory loss. There was a whole tranche of lost memories, weren't there? A whole
load
of
books. Threw me. I didn't remember. I thought it was very good.
And the author again was
Emma Healy.
Emma Healy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
thank you, Stephanie.
And now Linda is going to read us her work in progress.
Okay, this continues from the last scene we did when Eli is singing on the square to a crowd and Mary Magdalene is in the drugstore across the street trying not to watch him out the window, but she can't resist sometimes. The woman talking here is Melba, who works at the drugstore. She says, "Lordy mercy, that's a good-looking man." Melba was looking out the window at Eli, who was singing and hitting some hot licks on his guitar. She was chewing her gum in time to the music. "Looks like Dean Martin, don't he?" "Who?" Mary Magdalene asked. "Dean Martin, the movie star. You never heard of him?" Mary Magdalene shook her head. "Look right there," Melba said, pointing to the magazine rack. "See there? He's starring in this movie, Hollywood or Bust." Melba brought the magazine over to Mary Magdalene so she could see better. Sure enough, There was a good-looking man on the cover named Dean Martin. Mary Magdalene looked out again at Eli. He was smiling, looking as happy as she'd ever seen him. Melba had gone back to looking out the window. She was smiling, too. Mary Magdalene squinted her eyes and looked at Eli some more. Miss Patty had said you could see things a lot clearer if you squinted your eyes. Yes, ma'am, she said to Melba. He does look kind of like that. I never have thought much about how he looked. Melba popped her gum and looked at Mary Magdalene. You know him? Yes, ma'am, I do. He's my daddy. Melba's jaw dropped. Well, now, don't that just dill your pickle. Where's your mama? She died last year from the tuberculosis. Melba rushed over to give Mary Magdalene a hug, which was awkward because Mary Magdalene didn't move from the booth to accommodate Melba's compassion. Oh, bless your heart, baby. I'm so sorry. Melba went back to looking at the square. When he gets done singing over there, just have him come in here, and I'll make both of you the best hamburger you ever eat. Okay? Mary Magdalene nodded without speaking. She watched the little dog trying to nudge between people's legs on the square. She wished she and Eli could have a dog. Aunt Sugar had Chitlins, her cat, which Mary Magdalene thought of as hers as well, being as how she had spent so much of her time there after Mama got sick. People were afraid for her to be around Mama then because she might catch it. Melba turned and said, I'm going to the bathroom, honey. If anybody comes in, just tell them I'll be right out here. Yes, ma'am, I will. Mary Magdalene looked back out at the square where the crowd was clapping in time and Eli was singing Camping in Canaan Land. She felt kind of sad, mixed with something else that was not sad, just different. She realized there might be things about Eli that she didn't know, and somehow it mattered, but she wasn't sure how or why or how much. She wished she could talk to Aunt Sugar. Melba came out of the bathroom wearing fresh lipstick. Why, hon, you look like you're about as lost as last year's Easter egg. What's wrong?
That's brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant.
I just love just dill your pickle.
Oh, that just dill your pickle.
I think you made that one.
Why not?
Anybody says, well, you can do a lot of those. Well, then that just peel your banana. Well, that just slash your tomato.
Oh, save some, save some.
Don't throw them away.
It's
not original.
It is, or it's not. No, it's not.
Yeah. And I love Miss Patty had said you could see things a lot clearer if you squinted your eyes.
Yeah, it's pure Mary Magdalene, isn't it? And reminding us she's a child.
Yeah.
And as well as, you know, we started to see Eli from the outside. We talked about this in the previous bit that led
into
this.
Actually, it was your suggestion that that might be true, and I used it. So.
But we're seeing now Mary Magdalene from Melba's point of view as a pity, an object of pity or somebody deserving of compassion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I love the awkward hug because I can remember as a child, you know, you get crushing little paper hugs and you're like, I'm not coming to meet you on this.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, yeah, it's really great. So we see now she's an object of compassion. And also when she says, she wished she could talk to Aunt Sugar. You feel sad for Mary Magdalene, whereas before we've kind of seen her as quite tough, and which she is, but we're seeing a little different aspect of her, which I really like.
I particularly enjoyed the way that, you know, she was in that way that children are so self-obsessed, although she was starting to see Eli as a different a person rather than a parent. Immediately her attention went straight to her own concerns, you know, the little dog. And the cat called Chitlin, who I absolutely love.
Yeah.
And you know, the contrast there, but her sheer indifference, really, to anything that doesn't really affect
and
her.
And Melba, the first thing, as soon as she finds out, you know, that she's the daughter of this good-looking singer, she's like, where's your mum? I love that. And then she's off to get a bit heavy on. Subtle. You know, don't have to tell us she's setting her cap at Eon.
Yeah. And she says, oh, bring your daddy over for a hamburger.
Yeah. Free burgers, lipstick.
Oh, you never did it.
Yeah.
And it's so, the dialogue is so natural, so visual.
Melba chewing her gum in time to the music.
Yeah, I'm loving it.
What's the word when you're reading it and you actually see it playing out.
Yes, yes.
The letters playing out in front of you. Yeah. I think that's what.
Visceral?
It's not the word I would
say. Yeah, it just feels very authentic, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it doesn't. Nothing is forced. Nothing is forced. Yeah, absolutely.
I can see the movie too, definitely.
Now, I've always wondered, why do they call them drugstores when they're actually cafes?
Well, they're not. They're pharmacies.
And
pharmacies dispense drugs.
Okay. So they just evolved as cafes come as well.
They used to have anyway. Most of them, now it's not true anymore, but used to be most of the drugstores would have a soda fountain counter. So you could go in and get a hamburger sandwich or malted milk or whatever. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a full, restaurant. But they had this little service at the counter. I don't know why they stopped doing it. It was nice, but but anyway, and they had those stools around the counter that would turn.
I can see it all. There was one area, Linda, that I think I personally would like you to explore how Mary Magdalene comes to the conclusion. It says she felt kind of sad mixed with something else that was not sad, just different, which is lovely because that's exactly how children can't articulate what they're feeling. But then. And it says she realised there might be things about Eli she didn't know. And I would have liked to have gone with her on that journey and understood how she realised rather than just be told that she realised. And I think you're a good enough writer that you could take us on that journey of realisation about what it was that...
What she'd realised.
She's realised there might be things about Eli that she didn't know. And I kind of get what you're getting at because she's suddenly seen him through Melba's eyes. But I'd quite like you to expand on that and help us to go with her on her inner dialogue as to how she reached that. Yeah. Because Melba's just said something and she's ignored Melba and gone on to look at the dog. But now perhaps she's seeing other women making eyes at him and from the crowd or...
Well, perhaps she can remember a time when something odd happened that she didn't really understand.
I would like to know how she realised. That's really clutching at straws because there's nothing. Very little to fault. Yeah. And nothing to fault.
I couldn't find anything. I found two very, very minor points. Not fault, just possibilities. People were afraid for her to be around Mama then. Because she might catch it, and I just wondered whether they thought she might catch it.
Yeah, I was under the illusion she was suffering from cancer, not tuberculosis.
Oh, a bit of continuity problem here.
I have to go back through and make a bunch of stuff fit, but I'm just going to keep writing right now. They thought because.
And then
she felt kind of sad mixed with something else that was not sad, just different. Although I loved the concept, I thought mixed with was a little bit awkward, and I just thought and would.
I don't know. I loved it as it was. The only little teeny tiny critique I have. And it's very, very hard, isn't it? Melba's jaw dropped.
Yeah.
Bit of a cliche.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that I can find. Otherwise, I just think it's just stunning.
Maybe just stop chewing.
Well, whatever. You can find another way to express surprise. Unless, I don't know. It's Mary Magdalene's mind.
Right.
And maybe that's how she imagines surprise. But, she has some original turns of phrase herself, so
But
if you don't change it, it's fine.
Thank you.
It's just it's
just wonderful.
Yeah,
and we just want to read more.
Well, thank you.
You better get on with your writing.
Get the book.
I only want to do it in audio book though. I don't want to read it. I want to listen to it because listening to you read, Linda, it's like Mary Magdalene is. You're Mary Magdalene, really, aren't you?
Yeah, I think I am.
Yeah.
Except that she was so much smarter and sourer than I was. I was just a shy little girl.
You were smart.
I was smart, but didn't know it. Thank you. Thank you all so much. You always make me feel encouraged.
And I do want a book and an audio book. Yeah. I want a signed book.
from you, as well as the audiobook.
Yeah, hardback.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you, Linda.
Nicola.
So I found some interesting facts around sci-fi. As you know, that's my passion, and particularly where sci-fi pre-shadows real life. And so we started at the very beginning, and the phrase science fiction is first found in print in 1851.
Mm.
And the term genetic engineering was invented by science fiction author Jack Williamson in his 1951 novel Dragon's Island, which I looked up and I found it had the prerequisite Lady Deshabillée, looking like she needs rescuing from something.
Oh, those 1950s kind of covers.
Very Pulp Fiction sort of kind of looking cover. It was wonderful. And the interestingly enough, I'm just reading a book that's a prequel to an existing trilogy. And the first by Julian May, and I'm going to talk about that in another episode. The term prequel was first used in 1958 in reference to a novel by science fiction author James Blish. And the name, I'm very obsessed with parallel universes, having watched Professor Brian Cox on BBC about time and space and all that stuff. But in fact, the phrase parallel universe was first used in H.G. Wells' 1923 novel, Men Like Gods.
Wow.
And isn't it interesting that all of these things were that have turned out to be scientifically correct, I find this stuff really interesting, were imagined by people first. Yeah. It's really astonishing. There's a really good bit here where it says, John Brunnan's 69 novel on Zanzibar uncannily predicted many features of the 21st century world, including Viagra, overpopulation and same-sex marriages. Whereas Looking Backward by Edward Bellamy predicted credit cards, garden cities, and electronic broadcasting.
Mm.
And I just find that so fascinating that people are imagining things. Of course, there was Leonardo da Vinci, who practically invented the helicopter back in the 15th century, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is incredible. And then, you know, Star Trek pre-shadowed loads of things, didn't they? Like the mobile phones and transporters
headsets
and everything,
Yeah, you know, I think it's really interesting. I was fascinated at how early prequel came and parallel universes were imagined. In some cases, does the science follow the fiction? So, for example, when H.G. Wells wrote about travelling to the moon, did that inspire people with the idea that maybe they could one day travel to the moon?
Possibly.
And certainly Arthur C. Clarke suggested the satellite communication system that we have.
He was
the first to come up with that idea. So
I've just been flying, and I was thinking, you know, how incredible it is that once you know that an aeroplane of a certain weight takes off at 163 miles an hour, it all seems so obvious and logical. But the people who invented or found flight, they were just working on they probably, you know, weren't thinking about it from a physics point of view. They're thinking about it from a mechanical point of view.
Probably, yeah.
So many things we don't know about physics that we've yet to find out, and I just find this stuff absolutely fascinating, which is great. That's the kind of book I write.
I was going to say that's really, really terrific because you like to write science fiction.
Yeah.
So it works out.
Yeah. Yes.
I just wish that one part of Star Wars, Star Trek, was right. You said about flying. It would be lovely to go say, beam me up, Scotty, get there without having to get to the airplane.
But would it? No. I'd be a bit worried about being a bit scrambled. I mean, a bit scrambled already, but I wouldn't have been worried about getting my
electrons. Wasn't there a book about somebody that got scrambled in a transportation machine?
It
got
mixed up
with a fly.
That's right. That was a 50s movie that was then remade in the 90s.
Was that Jeff Goldblum?
In the remake. In the remake it was, but it is an old movie.
There is a scene in Galaxy Quest. Remember where that happens.
Somebody was actually talking over Christmas about this fantastic film with everybody where someone was really aliens that weren't, and I was able to say, hand on heart, I'd actually seen it. The Galaxy Quest Night Round Your House.
Yeah.
Brilliant movie.
Thank you very much, Nicola. And now Pat is going to tell us the difference or something about passive and active voice.
Okay. A number of people have said that when they put their work up for critique, they're getting comments back complaining, criticising, that there is too much passive voice. And there seems to be this feeling that using the passive voice is a bad thing.
Mm, I get that all the time.
Yeah, and I don't actually think it is. But first of all, we need to talk about what is the passive voice. It's the opposite of the active voice. And we usually write in the active voice. And the active voice, put simply, is simply that a sentence tells what a person or thing does. And that's an active sentence. Passive sentence switches things around a little bit, and it tells what is done to someone or something. Okay? Bear that in mind.
So give us an example.
So it's a simple, okay.
John
hit the ball.
The ball was hit by John.
The ball was hit by John.
So active is John hit the ball.
Yeah.
Passive is the ball was hit by John.
Yeah. Okay. Well, might be useful to just do a little quick grammar revision, because you do need to understand what's meant by a verb and by the terms subject and object. Nicholas.
I've already lost.
I'm just waiting for you to look at me and say, sure enough, you did.
It's great. Okay, so in most sentences, you've got the subject of a sentence, and that's usually a person, place, or thing. And in most sentences, the subject is either doing some sort of action or it is being described. And almost all of the time, the subject is at the very beginning of an English sentence. So, for example, the dog bites. So you've got the dog, and it bites.
The action.
The object of a sentence appears at the opposite end, always after the action in the sentence. It, too, is usually a person, place, or thing. And in most sentences, it's the person, place, or thing to which the action is being done. So it receives the action.
So the dog bites John.
Or the dog bit the postman.
So right. the dog is
the subject. The postman is now the object.
And the biting is the verb.
And the biting, the bit, is the verb. Okay?
Yep.
But of course, not all sentences have objects. So that first example we gave, the dog bites, doesn't have an object. It's just the dog. The subject and the verb. And verbs are action words. Generally, they describe an action. But sometimes they're just used to describe states of existence. So, for example, the dog is vicious, not actually doing anything, it's just being. So,
it
is a state. So, is, are, were, and so on. But in most of the sentences you write, your verb will be an action. So, for example, the postman ran. That's what the postman did. He ran. And in most sentences, this is the usual order of the three components. Subject, then verb, then object. That's in the active voice. So put simply, A does something to B.
Subject does something to object.
Yeah. When you use the passive voice, you make the object of an action into the subject of the sentence. So in other words, the object, so in the postman, has something done to it by A. So if we say the dog bit the postman, what was the object?
The postman.
Right? To make this passive, we need to make the postman the subject to put it at the beginning of the sentence.
So the postman was bitten by the dog.
Well done.
Right. Oh, I feel strangely warm by that praise.
Yeah. So, obviously, the postman didn't bite the dog. Mm-hmm. So you're not just shifting them around. No, he was bitten by what?
The dog.
Zombies.
Was he a zombie dog, in fact?
As Teresa's friend Alison says,
if you can say it was done by a zombie, or if you can add by zombies at the end, it's passive voice, so the postman was bitten by zombies.
Yeah, because that's the other sort of element you need when you make it passive, or you write the passive, you very often need a by. Mm-hmm. It's not essential in all cases.
Mm. So the dog, the postman was bitten, without saying by what, by whom.
Yeah.
The postman was bitten, it is a passive construction.
The postman was bitten while delivering a letter. So the bit that's missing is what or whom he was bitten by.
Yes, and we'll come to that. We'll come to that later. So just to reiterate what you're doing when you write the passive, you're making the object of the action the subject of the sentence. You're changing the verb by using some form of the verb to be. So is, has been, will be, were, one of those. Plus the past participle of the relevant verb. You don't need to know what that means because you read enough and write enough to do it.
You don't need to know exactly how it's described. You know it instinctively.
Yeah, you do.
What do I know instinctively?
The past participle.
What? Grammar.
Without naming things and parts and so on, you understand the past participle without knowing what it's called.
I'll take your word for it.
All right. I'm going to test you. A couple of examples.
Oh, my goodness.
Right. Okay.
By Sandy. That's usually my answer.
Okay. Change this sentence from active to passive. Critics praised the film.
The film was praised by critics.
Yay! Okay. Now make this passive construction active. England has been invaded by the Romans, the French, and the Vikings.
The Romans, the French, and the Vikings have invaded Britain.
Good. Right, so we understand what they look like and how they're formed. The next thing is why. What are the problems with passive voice? Why?
Why do people think it's a bad thing?
It's a bad thing.
And why do I naturally write that way?
I don't know. I mean, by and large, we write in the active voice. Passive, if you analyse all the sentences in any one passage, you'll find that, you know, by far the greater proportion of them are active. It is the more usual. And that's because sentences written in the active voice, they're generally clearer, more direct, and more compact. That means that passive voice then can be wordy, can be a little bit
It's wordy. A little bit, what I discovered was from putting my writing through Hemingway to try and pull out the passive bit, was that the passive voice seemed a little more detached, step removed from being in the action.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the time passive voice requires awkward or lengthy or quite convoluted sentences. Instead of short, punchy, straightforward.
I think I've probably missed too many Victorian novels.
But and so most of the time, if you move or change a passive voice sentence to active voice, it will tighten your prose and make it more readable. Another criticism is that it can be very vague.
Especially if you forget to mention the zombies. If you say the children were dressed and you don't say who they were dressed by.
Yeah. It could have been anyone, couldn't it? Random zombie questions, and so on.
And people end up having to sort of reread and work out what's going on. But there are some times when using the passive voice is actually a good thing. You know, you said about that detachment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are times that is how you want it to be.
For example, if there was something very violent happening and the victim suddenly swapped into passive voice, you'd be able to tell that the victim was detaching themselves from what was happening to themselves.
Yeah, that's one where
somebody chewing on a neck and they want to just pretend it's not happening.
My neck is being chewed by someone.
Yeah.
I was astonished to discover a zombie hanging from my neck at the time.
But that's actually active, isn't it?
Yes, that's not a passive voice.
I was astonished.
Oh, right.
Yeah. But passive voice just does not have the impact that active voice does.
Yeah, but that depends on
the effect you want to create.
Okay. And if everything, it's like long sentences, short sentences. Mm-hmm. If you continually use long sentences,
you wear out your reader.
Yes. And too many short sentences can conversely be like quite tiring, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And as a writer, you balance them, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
Or you use them judiciously. In fact, your piece, Linda, that we've just critiqued, I really like. There was the part where she talks about Eli and realizing that she doesn't know everything about him, and then there's a little short sentence about she really wishes she could talk to
Sugar.
And that short sentence had real impact.
Yes, it's poignant, isn't it? And it comes after a long sentence, a couple of long sentences, and it works. It improves the rhythm of the piece.
So it's the same with using passive voice. But also, it's where you want the your focus to be. Because if you want the focus to be on the thing or the person receiving the action of the verb, so the object, rather than whoever or whatever is performing the action, then you need to use the passive voice. Mm-hmm. So if you say, the house was built in 1654, are we interested in who built it?
No, we know it's zombies. No, that's a great example, isn't it?
You're not interested in who built the house, you're interested in the house.
Yeah.
Otherwise, what would you say? Zombies or somebody else built the house in 1654?
Yeah, if it was zombies, you might be interested, but it's just built the house.
But were they zombie mongers?
I think we're zombie mongers.
Right.
Too far.
Or another one would be the road is being repaired.
Yes.
So we're interested in the road. We're not interested in, however, fascinating the inner life of the builders or the navvies working on the road.
Construction workers.
Well, yeah.
The road is being repaired by the citizens of the village because the government hasn't got the money to do so.
And they are being sustained by feeding on said villagers.
You might want to change that one around, but anyway. So if you want to put the focus on the object, on the people on the receiving end, then passive is a good way of doing that. Yeah. Another use is when the agent, the person doing the action, is unknown or unimportant. Mm-hmm. So a couple of the examples we've looked at there, they're unimportant, or the votes have been counted.
Yes.
Hmm. Yeah.
What would you say, people or zombies counted the votes?
Right.
You don't need, it doesn't sound right, does it?
No. Those are good examples.
They're really good examples.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. So active and passive voice are both perfectly legitimate.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when somebody criticises writing and says there's too much passive voice.
Yeah. I think it's a valid criticism, it's an opinion, and it might point you to realise, like in my case, your writing's a bit pompous or something like that.
Yeah.
And I think it's fine. But when I first started getting this all the time, I felt like these people have been on, they've all been on a creative writing course, and I didn't learn this stuff,
which I haven't been on.
Yeah, it's not fair.
There is another sort of good use, an important use for the passive, is when the writer actually wants to hide the agent's identity, not just that it's not important or it's unknown, but if you actually want to hide the identity for whatever reason. There's a famous example from Ronald Reagan talking about Contras. Mistakes were made.
Without taking any responsibility at all.
Absolutely.
Yes, clearly mistakes were made. Yeah.
So it is, it's about deciding what's the effect, as with all writing, what's the effect you want to create.
Yeah.
And not just saying, oh, I can't use the passive because it's not good for.
But being aware of why you're using it and what you're trying to achieve.
I mean, some sentences would just sound totally stupid if you, well, not totally stupid, but clumsy, if you tried to put them into the active voice.
Yeah.
When a mass of gases wrap around our planet, surely our planet is wrapped in a mass of gases.
Yes, it sounds better. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Gas wraps our planet. Gases wrap our planet.
Well, because it's our planet we're interested in.
I feel more educated and I understand now. Yeah. So thank you
very much.
Thank you, Pat.
Yes, we can do better next time.
Yeah, we're right.
Yeah, we've all know now. So we've all been looking forward to what we're going to do in 2019. Has anybody got any events that they're looking forward to?
Well, I came across Hudfest, which is a Huddersfield literary festival. It's on in March, the last week in March. And it just caught my eye because two very great writers of police procedurals will be there, Anne Cleaves and Kath Staincliffe. That's got you interested, Pat. You'll have to go to that, won't you? So that caught my eye. Whether I'll go or not, I don't know, but it certainly sounds like a good one.
Well, we're going to be talking to people that organise the Winchester Writers Festival in a few weeks, and I'm looking forward to that. That's in June, middle of June. They haven't actually announced who their keynote speaker will be yet. Well, hopefully we'll get that from them. We'll get advance notice from them when we speak to them. But the keynote speaker last year was Patrick Gale, and the year before that, the year I last went, it was Lem Sisay.
Oh, lovely.
both of whom just inspirational. Yeah, so yeah. I'm really looking forward to seeing who's on their agenda this year.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. Mm-hmm.
Mm. Well, I've got a brand new course, 6-week course from Curtis Brown Creative. I got the first module a few weeks ago, and I'm working through it diligently. The reading list is a rather daunting 20 books, which they don't recommend you try and read them all, but I've got to say a lot of them do look really good, so I've added that to my Sudoku. I'm really looking forward to the new Ian McEwan book, Machines Like Me, because I love Ian McEwan. But the big one really has got to be The Big Sky, coming from Kate Hudson.
Oh, I have that
on my list too.
It's been 9 years, but private investigator Jackson Brodie is back. And I'm a very new convert to Kate Hudson. I've read everything she's written so far, and I absolutely love her, so I can't wait to read that.
Yeah, I've got her on my list to books that I'm looking forward to.
Me too. That's funny.
I'm looking forward to having more retreats, day-long retreats our group has had before. I find them so productive and just a lot of fun to go out for a day and sit around and be quiet and write and then share. I look forward to having some more of those. I hope we can schedule those in somewhere. Yeah, we'll have to work that out.
Okay, I'm looking forward to a couple of book releases in addition to Big Sky by Kate Atkinson. Some time ago, I talked about Sam Bourne, who is a Guardian writer called Jonathan Friedland, but he writes under the pseudonym Sam Bourne, and he did Kill the President.
Oh, yeah. I remember.
This strange American president. Well, he's got a new one out in February called To Kill the Truth. I'm quite looking forward to that. There is a book of short stories set in Manchester, my home city, but Anne Kampala, called Manchester Happened. I'm quite looking forward to, particularly as well. I haven't seen, although it's not, it's already been released, I haven't yet seen the film Peterloo. I think this year there will be various events around that, which I'm quite looking forward to. I'm looking forward in December to the film of Cats.
Really?
Yeah. Because I never saw the show.
I think that's a mercy. A young friend of mine, whose grandmother is Austrian, her grandmother bought them tickets to see Cats in Vienna, and she was hilarious in her description of how bad it was, and how if it wasn't that their grandma had bought them the tickets, they would have all left at the interval.
But some people like it, so there you go.
Well, I've never seen it.
I used to love shows, but I never got to see Cats, so I'm quite looking forward to them. But the biggie for me is going to be the final book in Hilary Mantel's trilogy.
Of course, that's out this year.
Yeah, I haven't got a date for it. I couldn't find any date, but it should have been this last year, apparently, and then she said she got sidetracked and it was going to be 2019.
What is the name of the trilogy?
Well, it starts with Wolf Hall. The second is Bring Up the Bodies,
and it's all about
Thomas
Tudor. Okay, right. But it's beautifully written. Oh. She won the Man Booker
twice.
First two. The third win makes it the hat trick. Mm-hmm. It's going to be the summer for me, for books, really. June, as we've already mentioned, Kate Atkinson's Big Sky. I've got three books coming out in July and August that I can't wait for. Sweet Sorrow by David Nicholls. And I just love David Nicholls' work. So looking forward to that one. Platform 7 by Louise Doherty, who wrote Apple Tree Yard. Platform 7 is about a suicide at Peterborough Railway Station. So I'm looking forward to that. And finally, also in August, The Testament.
You know, next time I'm in the chair, I'm going first.
All right, I'll let you talk about The Testament.
I thought, Steph, you might have chosen The History of Faber.
They've got a centenary.
No, I'm looking ahead, not looking back.
Okay.
No, but The Testaments by Margaret Atwood, which I'll let you talk about.
Yes.
The other one was going to be Machines Like Me by Ian McEwan.
You bring yourself twice.
I've got some as well when you
Yes, The Testaments by Margaret Atwood. I love The Handmaid's Tale. And this is the sequel to The Handmaid's Tale, and I'm really looking forward to it.
I'm going to have to read it again.
I've seen series one on the television. I've got a series two on DVD. When my husband goes away, I can sit there and watch it. And absolutely loved it. And so really looking forward
to that coming out. And Nick has already said that Machines Like Me by Ian McEwan. I've just read The Children Act.
Yeah.
And I love the way he writes. Mm-hmm. And I'm really looking forward to that. And it says it's a submersive novel. Subversive.
Oh, subversive.
Slightly different to subversive.
Yeah. And it's the story of an alternative 1980s London, which just sounds absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
And the last one is somebody I've never heard of before, and it's called The Night Olivia Fell by Christina MacDonald. And when I just read, a little bit about it, so she's new to me, but the plot sounds fascinating. A girl falls off a bridge, she's brain dead and pregnant. She's kept alive to save the baby. Mm. Did she fall or was she pushed?
Ooh,
and it just sort of hit the nerve with me.
Mm.
But there is such a pile on my bedside table that it might take a while to get round.
Yeah. I've got a few books that I'm looking forward to. Coming soon on the 25th of March, a lost feminist classic that anticipated Brave New World, which is Rose McCauley's Whatnot.
Yes, I've got that on my list.
Handheld Press.
Mm.
Now, May is going to be a fantastic month for me because I've got a poetry book, I've got some fiction and some non-fiction that I'm really looking forward to, some favourite writers of mine. We've got Sandetti Light Vessel Automatic by Simon Armitage is coming out in May.
Yeah.
Armitage recently got the Queen's Gold Medal for poetry, but in this he's bringing together commissioned and collaborative work in this collection. I loved Paper Aeroplane, which is a kind of selection from his various earlier collections. So I'm looking forward to that. One of my favourite writers is James Elroy, and he's got This Storm coming out in May. The second novel in his second LA Quartet, so the sixth in a set of eight, in other words, set in the aftermath of Pearl Harbor. Mm. So that's going to be good. I just love his writing. And then Underland by Robert McFarlane. I don't know if any of you read his early works, Landmarks and the Old Ways. I think Pat would like Landmarks, in which he is trying to save, if you like, all the words we have for nature and the countryside. It was a response to the Oxford Junior Dictionary taking out words like Catkins.
I
really enjoyed reading it. Basically, dialect words, old words for water, for leaves, for trees, you know, all of those things. So this new book is called Underland. And it travels across space and through time as it goes underground and questions human treatment of the earth.
Hmm.
So again, I think there'll be lots of interesting vocabulary in that.
Yeah.
And then that's May, but in September, I just can't wait. The autobiography of John Cooper Clarke is coming out in September. Now, I had some discussion with my long-standing friend Sue Orty about John Cooper Clarke recently on Facebook and how he's become a national treasure. Whereas back in the day, he wasn't that at all. But he's very witty and clever, and I'm going to begrudge him his success, put it that way. But I should think that would be very interesting, because I do know at one point he said he was living in a house with half of Velvet Underground. And he's been to some very dark places as well, so I think that will be fantastic, and obviously it will be written in a very witty and clever way.
Do you know, when you said you were looking forward to September to an autobiography, I really thought you were going to say of David Cameron in September.
I don't think that will ever be on my list. I just don't think I'll get around to it because there's so many other things I want to do.
You can always go to the bottom.
Well, we're almost at the end of the podcast, but first, Teresa and Ludo Cinelli. They're going to share with us what's on their bedside table.
Well, I've been reading recently The Girl in the Green Dress by Kath Stainford. I mentioned earlier that she's going to be at the Hudfest. But this is a new discovery for me, although I believe she's written well over 20 police procedurals. I just love this book. It was really gripping and really well plotted. I enjoyed the very authentic characterisation and the way we get to see the flaws in all the characters, the good and the bad. But about a third of the way through, I thought, this is all going too well. This crime is solved now. What's he going to do with the rest of the book? Well, I needn't have worried. There was a great twist that took the book in a new direction. Obviously, I can't tell you about it, but I can say my interest didn't flag for a moment. I read it in 2 days flat, and I'm looking for more of her books to read.
Right. Oh, nothing nice and funny. A new author and funny, aren't you?
Yeah, it's great, isn't it?
What was her name again?
Kath Stainford. But don't worry, we'll be sharing the link.
Ludo Cinelli, what's on your bedside table?
At the moment, Middle England by Jonathan Coe is on my bedside table. I am a huge fan of his earlier novels like The Rotters Club, and I picked up this new one because it features a lot of the same characters. And this, so far, I'm not very far in, but it seems to be leading up to this very, very realistic and funny and sad portrait of Brexit Britain, really. It's very kind of fiercely contemporary in that sense. And yeah, I'm very much enjoying it. I don't get a lot of time to read for pleasure because there's so much reading to do for work. And so when I do get to have 5 minutes before bed, that's what I look forward to picking up at the moment.
Well, that was Right Club, the podcast. Do subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher or Radio Public so the new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. Join our Facebook group. Just search for Right Club, the podcast. And please leave a review. And please ask as many other people to listen to us as well. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.